It's been almost 2 weeks since the primary, and some races are still too close to call. Ahead on Insight, we'll look at the latest local and statewide results, as well as what this could signal for the November general. Also, 1 year ago today, the city of Sacramento approved a first-of-its-kind lease for an encampment, which was celebrated by advocates as a unique response to the ongoing homelessness crisis. But now, the future of the self-governing site, once seen as a model to apply around the state, is uncertain. We're going to get an update on camp resolution. Finally, almost 50 years ago, five Yuba County men left their homes to watch a basketball game in Chico and were never seen alive again. We'll speak with an author who has compiled details on their lives and is reinvigorating this cold case for the first time. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. First, here's the news. Camp Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Tomorrow marks 2 weeks since the primary, and we are still waiting for some important local and statewide races to be finalized. Locally, hanging in the balance, the Sacramento mayoral race is still up in the air. We still don't know which top two candidates will officially face off in November. In Sacramento County, the next batch of election results are due tomorrow afternoon, Tuesday, and there are less than 30,000 ballots to be processed, so there's still some wiggle room. And then, of course, there's Prop 1, the statewide mental health and housing bond Governor Newsom had been pushing pretty hard, the yes side leading by a razor-thin margin. Prop 1 opponents have conceded, but it still remains too close to call. Joining us today to get an update on the vote count, the vote trends, turnout, and more are Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data Incorporated, and political strategist Mike Madrid. Thank you both. Good afternoon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start local with the mayoral race in the city of Sacramento, Paul. It has been a really suspenseful, interesting race. Each ballot drop on Tuesday or Friday, things can really change drastically. Currently, we have epidemiologist Dr. Flojan Kofer leading at 28%. But then the other three, Assemblymember Kevin McCarty, former state senator Richard Pan, former city council member Steve Hansen, they're all in a tie. I mean, they're only separated by a couple hundred votes. What's stands out to you about this race?
Well, you're exactly right. What's interesting is when we first talked right after the election, Flo Kofer was actually in fourth. And I actually had a reporter call me and say, well, can we just assume this is a three-person race now that she's out of it? My response was no, that a lot of these late ballots that are coming in were a lot younger. They potentially were a pool of voters that was a lot better for Flo Kofer, and that held true. She now has kind of an enormous lead for the for how tight this race has been. I think she has essentially punched her ticket to go into the general election with these other three candidates really jostling in these late ballots. And they seem to kind of pull from each other a lot. Richard Pan has been in the lead up until recently. And that's probably buoyed by a lot of the early votes from Asian voters who traditionally have done better in vote by mail in those early ballots. And maybe that has been slipping a tiny bit. But there's still, you know, 7,500 or more ballots to tabulate, we expect. That's our estimate. When you look precinct by precinct, there's actually more precincts or more votes in the precincts that Pan won that are still outstanding. That doesn't mean he's going to win those votes, but it just means that that might be something that he can cling to. And then, of course, McCarty is ahead by, I think, 160 votes. And you'd always want to be ahead than behind.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting looking hyper-local because statewide, according to your data, I mean, voter turnout has been like 30%. I mean, that's going to change as we continue to get more ballots processed. But what does voter turnout look like for the city of Sacramento? I mean, this is a big race for people in the city.
Yeah. So the city of Sacramento is at 39% turnout. And then when you look even more locally, Council District 4 is over 50% turnout. And that is one of the historically lower turnout areas in the city with that downtown area. Previously, it was downtown and Land Park. And so Land Park was a base of voters. Now it's downtown in East Sac. And we see higher turnout in that council district. And also in that race, you know, Katie Valenzuela versus Phil Pluckybaum, a real polarizing race with literally Alhambra Boulevard dividing. She won every precinct north of Alhambra Boulevard, and he won every precinct south. So it's an interesting race.
Yeah, and Katie Valenzuela is the current city council member. And as it stands now, Phil Pluckeybaum is in the lead at 52% versus 43%. Ballots, of course, still being processed. What impact do you think redistricting had on this city council district? Because now it includes East Sacramento.
Yeah, I mean, the redraw was essentially everything for this district because, you know, in decades past, they used to take the downtown area and split it up so that everybody had a piece of downtown in their district, but essentially nobody cared a lot about downtown. It was just only a part of a small part of their district. Now there's a downtown core. And the question was in redistricting, in the last two redistrictings, where does this downtown pair up? Does it downtown pair up with Natomas or with Land Park or with East Sac? And it switched from a Land Park downtown to a East Sac downtown. And then Kate Valenzuela, who's the incumbent council member, did become somewhat of a polarizing figure, particularly to those East Sacramento voters, many of whom attempted unsuccessfully to recall her, even though they hadn't voted for her. And this election seems to kind of be showing again that divide, essentially with Alhambra Boulevard being the, I guess it's east-west, not north-south split of the of that district.
Mm. Well, Mike, I mean, you're an expert in political strategy, outreach, demographics. I mean, before we go statewide, what stands out to you about these local city races?
You know, Sacramento as a city has always kind of fascinated me. It's obviously, you know, I guess my hometown. I've lived here for 20 years, but in many ways, it's so different from other cities and states that are working across the country. I think there's a danger in almost reading too much about the ideology of what was driving voters. This is still very much a small town. A lot of people who were actually voting in this election knew one or more of these candidates, certainly for mayor. And I think in the Valenzuela, you know, Pluckeybaum seat, this was a really, I live in that district. I live in Midtown. I'm one of those people who voted for Pluckeybaum in probably the most Valenzuela district because, you know, the issue of homelessness just really, you know, burst through everything that I was thinking about and reminds me, as somebody who looks at these mega trends, that, you know, these local issues do make a very big difference and define these candidates. It clearly did in that race. That was just a huge divining rod. In the other race, this, you know, I think it's healthy for Sacramento to have that competitive a race where there are that many candidates running that close. And we'll just, you know, we'll have to see. I mean, I think it's probably pretty clear with these where who's going to make the top two, but you know, there are still votes to be counted.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to Prop 1, that was the only proposition on the ballot statewide. Governor Newsom lobbied heavily for it. I mean, part of it included voters approving a $6.4 billion bond in addition to like restructuring how the state spends money on mental health and which relates to homelessness as well. It is leading by a razor thin margin. I mean, Mike, given that it's barely squeaking by, there was a lot of lobbying and campaigning on Governor Newsom's behalf. If this does get approved by voters, even a narrow margin, is this still a victory or does this actually impact his political clout?
Well, a victory is a victory. I mean, if you win by, you know, one vote, ultimately no one's going to remember it probably in a couple of weeks. And you know, people like Paul and I will look at this as a data point for forever and it will tell us something. But the average person isn't going to be like, well, it only, you know, passed by a handful of votes. So, yeah, look, it's causing some heartburn and some angst. But for the most part, I think it's in pretty safe ground. And again, I think there are some bigger dynamics that probably needed to and should be considered. It's easy to armchair quarterback now. You know, was going in March a good idea? Did the ballot label, you know, give them everything they wanted since they were able to, you know, craft this thing? Yeah, what does it say about the governor's support levels or opposition with, you know, I'm just one of those people that never believes putting a politician out front of any measure for anything, especially when you're asking for money, is a good idea. That's not necessarily a referendum on Gavin Newsom. It's just a referendum on politicians. It's just not a wise strategy. But again, like I said, it's easy to armchair quarterback. I really think a lot of this is going to be overblown. If this does pass, which I suspect it probably will, I don't think people are going to remember it in 10 days, 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, given that the margin right now between yes and no on Prop 1 is like 20,000 votes, I mean, opponents of Prop 1, they officially conceded last week, but is that still too narrow given that ballots are still being processed?
Well, we're actually looking at where those ballots that are still being processed are from. And so counties like Alameda, Santa Clara are big sets of data still to come. It's those more conservative rural counties where it really lost big numbers. And so I think when we look at the outstanding ballots, that is favorable to the ballot measure. And so I think it will, like Madrid, I agree that it will pass. And then if I was, you know, spinning this for the Newsom side, I would just say, look, this was the electorate that would be the least amenable to a, you know, spending measure, to this kind of a ballot measure in a decade. It was a more conservative electorate in this primary than it would have been if there had been competitive presidential races. And even in this very kind of unfavorable electorate, it was able to pass. And it helps avoid putting this on a general election ballot, or maybe it would get crowded with other fiscal issues. And you could have that situation where voters start voting against spending because of all the spending measures. So victory is a victory, like Mike said, and I think they're in a good position in terms of the outstanding ballots.
On the topic of spending locally, Measure C in Sacramento isn't looking good, and this would have gradually increased Sacramento's city business operations tax. The city says this hasn't been done since 1991, but 62% are against it so far. Do you think that there's a larger message about where voters stand right now when it comes to how state and local governments collect and spend money? Mike?
Yeah, look, there's no question there is. And any time that the perception of the economy is shaky or not doing well or heading into bad times, voters are going to be less amenable to opening up their pocketbook to anything, you know, especially government and government services. I also think this measure was particularly poorly rolled out. It kind of just came out and surprised everybody. And you know, my firm focuses on this with local governments. We've been experts in this for 25, 30 years. I've never seen anything kind of sprung on the voters like this and just like, oh, no, this is just a modernization or an update. Just very, very poorly rolled out. But there's also no question the appetite for bonding and taxing is just not going to be there. You know, all of the economic indicators are heading in one direction. Public sentiment is moving in the opposite direction. That's going to need to be reconciled by the politicians and by their teams to start saying, how are we going to start spending or asking the taxpayers slash voters to give us the benefit of the doubt to start moving forward with some of these measures. But this is kind of, you know, exhibit A on things on how not to proceed with a tax measure.
Mm. Another close race is Assembly District 6, or it's an interesting dynamic. I wouldn't necessarily call it close because Assembly District 6, which is in our area, I mean, there were 10 candidates in this race, seven of whom were Democrats, two were Republican, one was Peace and Freedom. And I'm curious how this race, given that California is a top two, regardless of party, like, did the Democrats candidates in this race, did they dilute the power of the Democratic vote? Because it looks like we're going to have a Democrat and a Republican in the top two ticket for November, Paul.
Yeah, so this was an interesting race, and going into it, there were two candidates on the ballot, and my perception was that it was almost a guarantee that one of the candidates, I presumed it would be Nikki Ellis, would be the one that would make it into the top two, because the Democrats had kind of a nasty campaign with a lot of negative mail going back and forth. So Maggie Krell definitely stood out, and the data suggested that she would be able to win, and then my guess was, you know, Nikki Ellis being second. On election night, I was talking to some consultants. I had one consultant tell me that she couldn't win because she didn't have a website. When we were doing the election night coverage on one of the local TV affiliates, they came up with the results showing Maggie Krell and then Nikki Ellis, and they literally just had the little silhouette of a head, you know, female shape there, because they didn't have a picture of her. So this was a surprise to many, but when you look around the state, there are a lot of Republicans who got into the second spot, even if those Republicans were less well known, because you had this elevated Republican turnout, combination of a, you know, more interesting Republican primary on the Republican side, even though it was essentially over. And then potentially the more than $10 million spent in promoting Garvey's candidacy in the U.S. Senate race. We actually did some polling after the election and found that, you know, in some pockets of the electorate, conservative independents and more moderate Republicans, they cited the U.S. Senate race as the number one reason why they turned out to vote. So that elevated Republican participation really allowed a lot of Republicans to make it into runoffs, even if they were relatively unknown.
Mm. In the last minute that we have, Mike, I mean, now sights are on November. Voter turnout as it stands today is like 30%. I mean, it's not great. What do you think it'll take to drive people to the polls in November?
I think we're going to have a very robust turnout in November, because Voters are much more motivated now by what we call negative partisanship, which means we all know what partisanship means and hyperpartisanship. But negative partisanship is kind of when it all metastasizes and people vote against things more than they vote for things. So even though there is not, and again, this low turnout is something we're seeing all over the country. This is not unique to California. When people are motivated and the existential threat that both parties see and feel about the other party becomes real, voters will be motivated. Now, they will be voting more against somebody than for somebody, but we have been in a period of pretty high sustained turnout. 2018, we had the highest, you know, midterm turnouts in like 100 years. 2020 was a record high turnout. 2022, you know, was second to 2018. So voters are scared. They're afraid that if their team doesn't win, that the, you know, the Republic's going to end, and they're voting accordingly. So, you know, look, we've seen this low turnout. You can ascribe it to non-competitive primaries. There's some truth to that. You can ascribe it to historically high negatives from both candidates. There's some truth to that. But the reality is when it's a face-to-face between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, people are going to show up.
Mike Madrid is a political strategist, and Paul Mitchell is the vice president of Political Data, Inc. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 1 year ago, Sacramento took a unique approach in response to a growing number of people experiencing homelessness. In North Sacramento, the city approved a first-of-its-kind lease for an existing encampment known as Camp Resolution, which means this encampment became a self-governed, city-sanctioned site at a time when affordable housing units are in limited supply. The move was celebrated as a win for homelessness advocates critical of sweeps, and it was watched closely by other cities as possibly a model to replicate across the state. But 11 months in, the fate of Camp Resolution is still up in the air. The Sacramento County District's Attorney's Office has threatened prosecuting the city-sanctioned encampment, demanding that Camp Resolution shut down and labeling the site as a public health hazard. And it seems like the city's investment in Camp Resolution is in limbo. Marisa Kendall reports on homelessness for Cal Matters, a nonprofit newsroom that partners with public media stations across the state, and joins us with an update on Camp Resolution. Good afternoon, Marisa.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So what was unique about Camp Resolution as a response to homelessness in the city of Sacramento?
Yeah, so Camp Resolution started out as a homeless encampment that just organically formed on this vacant city lot, and the city was going to shut it down and clear the camp. And the residents fought back, and they attended a city council meeting en masse, and they actually convinced city leaders to not clear the camp and instead to give them a lease that legally allowed them to be there. And it was just a really interesting resolution because, you know, that doesn't happen. You don't see cities leasing their land to homeless individuals and allowing them to stay there and manage themselves. So it was a really interesting development there.
And you recently visited Camp Resolution not too long ago. Can you give us a visual, describe what it looks like?
Yeah, so there's about 50 people living there. There's 16 trailers that are fairly nice trailers that were from the state and then provided to the camp through the city. And then the rest of the people who were not lucky enough to get one of these trailers live in their own trailers that maybe are more run down, live in tents, live in cars. They've tried to make it, the residents have tried to make it nice. They're putting in a garden, building raised planter beds out of pallets. There's little potted plants. They try to clean up the trash. But they don't have any running water or electricity, which has made things difficult for them.
Oh, so they have no running water. So how do they manage day by day?
Yeah, so they get a lot of donations from the community, which includes a lot of bottled water. So they're getting big jugs of bottled water. Sometimes they're, you know, trying, a lot of people there have generators. So sometimes they're trying to heat up the water to take little sponge baths. At one point, they did have a nonprofit coming by a few times a week with shower trailers. But yeah, there's a lot of complaints from residents that, you know, they need more help. They need more resources.
Mm. Who lives there and how were these people selected?
Yeah, so it's mostly just the same group that started, that originally was there. And it's a lot of women who would not feel safe living on their own on the street because things can be really dangerous if you're an unaccompanied woman out there. A lot of older people and some people with severe medical issues. There's a woman there on dialysis. There's a woman with a heart condition who uses a motorized scooter. So, you know, some folks who really probably shouldn't be there and should be in a higher standard of care.
Given that this is a self-governed site, how does that work and is it effective?
Yeah, so there's a married couple, two women who sort of founded the site and make a lot of the decisions. They also have a council of residents who meets once a week to talk about any issues that are happening. And they sort of, you know, make the rules and determine what happens. They were complaining to me, though, they don't really have any way to enforce these rules. You know, even if they were to try to kick somebody out of the camp, they don't really have a relationship with the city or with the local police where they would come and help these residents enforce their rules. So they rely a lot on just the strength of the bonds that they've formed within the community. Hmm. And for the most part, that part works fairly well from what I've seen. You know, when I was there, there was a small pile of trash in the middle of the camp. And the two women who run the camp sort of made a comment, well, that shouldn't be there. And as they said that, a few minutes later, I saw other residents come to the pile and start cleaning it up. Hmm. So there is you know, a lot of teamwork going on there.
And those people who run the encampment, the city-sanctioned encampment, are Joyce and Sharon Jones. And as you mentioned, they are married. Tell us about them. And how did they end up at Camp Resolution?
Yeah, so they've been homeless about 7 years. It started with a dispute with their landlord that led to an eviction. They lived in hotels for a while until they basically just ran through their savings and couldn't afford to do that anymore. So then they ended up on the street and they ended up at this camp and sort of, you know, forming this community and, you know, basically taking over this campsite and essentially making history when they got that city-sanctioned designation.
And this was potentially looked at as a model by other cities. Like, hey, maybe we can replicate this because there is just such a shortage of affordable housing across the state. It seems like that isn't necessarily moving forward when you checked into Camp Resolution, you know, 11 months into this was approved by the city. So what has happened?
Yeah, so around the state, sanctioned encampments in general are becoming a more popular solution, partly because cities want to crack down on removing encampments from areas around schools, waterways, that sort of thing. But legally, they can't do that unless they have somewhere to send these people. So San Jose is considering sanctioned encampments. San Diego has created two. But there's a lot of different ways you can make a sanctioned encampment. And generally, what cities will do is they will hire a nonprofit to run the camp, and the nonprofit will decide who comes in and who goes. They will set the rules. It's governed in a very paternalistic, very top-down way. Sometimes there's curfews, and sometimes the residents really feel like they're being treated like children, or they'll equate it to being like in a jail. So a self-governed model where the residents set the rules themselves is really held up as sort of the gold standard by advocates. In San Diego, when they launched Camp Resolution, you know, the city manager said this could be a model for future sites. And he was supposed to come up with new sites where either this model or a different type of sanctioned encampment model would happen. They launched one since then. It is not a self-governed model. It's on Roseville Avenue in North Sacramento. So they put a bunch of tiny homes and trailers there. But then I asked, and they said they don't have any plans to create more because of the budget deficit the city's experiencing. Yeah, it was really, it seems like this might be just a one and done situation.
And it's currently in a legal dispute as well. The Sacramento County District Attorney, Tin Ho, has been critical of how the city enforces and manages encampments across the city. And he also takes issue with this safe ground, self-governing site in North Sacramento, Camp Resolution. What is the argument that the DA's office is making about wanting Camp Resolution to be removed?
Yeah, he says it's a health hazard. The site used to be an auto maintenance yard, and he's concerned with gasoline and other chemicals that were once buried under the ground. He says the soil's contaminated and it's toxic for the residents living there. He has threatened to prosecute the city. He says the site's being operated illegally. It's unclear what, if anything, is going to come of that. He told the city to close the site, but he didn't provide any deadline for them to do that by or really make clear like what his next steps would be. And as you mentioned, he has been really critical of the city's approach to homelessness in the past. Separately, he's sued the city in civil court for their approach to homeless encampments. So this may just be, you know, sort of another sort of attack against the city's response to this crisis.
But I also learned and was really surprised in your reporting. I mean, there's a wait list for Camp Resolution in the hundreds. So that indicates that there is an appetite for this from people who are housing insecure. So what is the argument that you're hearing either from homelessness advocates or people who live currently at Camp Resolution as to why this is their best option today?
Yeah. So, you know, if you visit the camp, Camp Resolution is on the inside of a fence, and right on the outside of the fence, there's dozens more homeless people living, you know, in their cars, in shacks, in just a row of RVs extending down the street. And from the folks inside in Camp Resolution, what I heard is, you know, it's not perfect. We wish it was better. We wish we were not outside. But being inside the fence with this community is much better than being outside on your own. You know, not only do they have the security that they can stay there, they're not going to be kicked out by law enforcement. They don't have to pack up their things and move every week. They're not at risk of law enforcement coming and maybe throwing away their possessions. But they do have that community, which can really be life or death if you're a woman out there.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, I mean, there are some people living at Camp Resolution that have really dire medical conditions. You also talked about Joyce and Sharon Jones, who run Camp Resolution. They have been experiencing homelessness for 7 years. What did you learn about their challenges? Do they in trying to find stable housing and what they're running up against?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the people I spoke with are on wait lists for housing, and they're hopeful that they will get housing at some point. According to Joyce and Sharon, 6 people have gotten housing from inside Camp Resolution so far. So, you know, 6 out of about 50 over the course of a year shows you how tough it is. And especially because, like I mentioned, and like you said, you know, a lot of these folks are older and do have health issues. And those are generally the people who are prioritized to get permanent housing. So the fact that they're still out there really, I think, speaks to, you know, the fact that we have such limited housing options right now.
In the last 30 seconds that we have, what's next for the camp? I mean, I'm sure you're going to keep following this. It seems like it's in limbo right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen with the legal threats. We're not, it's also unclear, even how long the city would let it stay there. They have the option, every month to cancel the lease if they want to. They haven't said anything about that, about doing that. But that's always a possibility. And right now, the residents are just waiting to see what happens. They're not that worried about the threat by the district attorney's office. They haven't heard anything specific from him, so they're hoping they just will be allowed to stay there.
Marisa Kendall is a reporter with Cal Matters. Marisa, thank you for the time and your reporting.
You're welcome.
Marisa was sharing an update on Camp Resolution, which is the first self-governed homeless encampment approved by the city of Sacramento, whose fate is in limbo. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Almost 50 years ago, in February of 1978, five Yuba County men went to see a basketball game in Chico and were never seen alive again. The car they were traveling in was found abandoned on a snow-covered road in the Plumas National Forest, dozens of miles in the wrong direction from their homes. Four of the men's bodies were found months later, while the fifth remains missing to this day. Many details about the men's disappearance and the investigations that followed have been captured for the first time in a new book. It's titled Things Aren't Right: The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five. The author, Tony Wright, has spent 4 years researching this case and joins us now. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on the show, Vicky.
So, Tony, you are not from here. You're not from California. You live out of state. What got you interested in this unsolved mystery, this unsolved cold case in Yuba County?
I live in Michigan, and around 2018, I started watching original YouTube true crime content. And the creators on YouTube were covering a story called the Yuba County Five. I thought the story was fascinating and heartbreaking. So I went to my library looking for a book, no luck, went on to Amazon looking for a book, no luck. I thought someone would write a story about this case, and nothing was available at the time. So I decided to write a book on the case and spent roughly 4 years looking at the case files, interviewing family, law enforcement, the media, and anyone that would talk to me about the case. And the end result is this book.
I mean, this is a 4-year endeavor, as you just laid out. I mean, did you envision going on this journey when you first learned about this cold case, this unsolved mystery?
No, at first I thought, wow, that's a really fascinating case, and it was incredibly heartbreaking. But the more people covered it on podcasts and on YouTube, and there were articles about the case, the SACB had a 2-day story in 2019, it was a story that just kept getting my attention. There was something about the case that just attracted me to it. And I thought, I've got a background in history. I'm an archivist. I work in records management. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to write a book about the case. And once I jumped in, I knew there was no going back. I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to give up. I've got to be as tough of a investigator as possible and go all in. And that's what I did for about 4 years. It was even during COVID. I was able to do quite a bit over the phone and talk to families and law enforcement, and it was a heck of a journey. I had no idea it would take me 4 years.
And as it stands today, I mean, it's still unknown what happened to these five men on that fateful night, February 24th, 1978. Introduce us briefly to who these people were who made up the Yuba County Five.
The five were Ted Weir, who was 32 years old. There was Jack Madruga, who was 30 years old. There was Bill Sterling, who was 29 years old. You also had Jackie Hewitt, who was about 23 years old, and Gary Mathias, who was roughly 24 years old at the time when they disappeared. Four of the men had intellectual disabilities, and Gary Mathias had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. They were all residents of the Yuba County area up near Marysville. They were part of a program called the Gateway Projects, and that was a local nonprofit that provided jobs to people with intellectual disabilities and mental illness. Plus, they did life coaching for people, just giving them information on living independently and how to handle everything from a checkbook to, you know, taking care of a home, preparing meals, things like that. But what was great about Gateway is that they had a Special Olympics basketball team called the Gateway Gators. And the five of these men were part of that basketball team. So they were all athletes. They loved going out to go roller skating. They loved bowling. They would walk to and from places. They could cover miles upon miles just because, you know, not everyone would be able to give them a ride somewhere. Only two of the guys had driver's license at the time. And Jack Madruga was sort of the driver of the group. So he owned a 1969 Mercury Montego. And on February 24th, 1978, they decided to drive up to Chico because their favorite college basketball team, UC Davis, was playing Chico State in the game. It's getting close to the end of the basketball season. UC Davis is doing well. They decide, oh, we got to go check out our favorite basketball team. And it was important to them because the next day on February 25th, they would go down to Rockland for a Special Olympics basketball tournament. So it was around 6 p.m. on the 24th when they went to a game at Chico State. They watched UC Davis win. The team basically did a good job of playing that night, and they went to a convenience store to get some snacks in Chico. They got on the road and just vanished off the face of the earth. And the car they were traveling in was found 4 days later up in the Plumas National Forest.
Yeah, and just to visualize how odd it was where they were found, I mean, these men lived in Yuba City and Marysville. Those are two cities that are right by each other in Sutter and Yuba counties. So you'd take like Highway 99 to get to Chico. But this car that was found abandoned was found dozens of miles away east in between Lake Oroville and Bucks Lake in the Plumas National Forest. And their bodies, the four of the five which have been recovered in this time, weren't in the car. They were actually miles away. And this was, there was snow. It was during winter. What did you, during your investigation, talking to family, how did you better understand the circumstances surrounding their deaths? What, do you have a better idea of what happened?
I mean, I learned more talking to the families that their car was abandoned on a road to nowhere near a place called Rogers Cow Camp. So they would have had to take the Oroville Quincy Highway to get to the place where they abandoned the car, which was probably, 4,000 feet up in the Plumas and the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. And what we know is the driver, Jack Madruga, did not like to deviate from his driving plans. It seemed, from my perspective, the guys wanted to go to the game in Chico and come back home, get as much rest as possible, because the next day they would have to go to downtown Marysville to meet up with their basketball coach and drive down to Rockland. So these guys live very set lives. They wanted to do what they want to do, and to deviate from the highway and to drive through Oroville up into the place where they abandoned the car was so out of character for these men. And it's an incredibly tragic story because they weren't left in the, they didn't stay in the car. They got out and walked probably 12 miles to these trailers. And Ted Weir was found in one of the trailers, and Jackie Hewitt, Bill Sterling, and Jack Madruga were found different distances away from the trailer. So this really baffled law enforcement. This was totally out of character for them to be in this location, to be away from their families. They would do things like in the summer, go swimming and enjoy a hike or go hunting, but to go in a place where there's snow, there's dark, it's way off course from going home. It's still a mystery to this day what got them off the road and into a location far from home.
When you talk to family members, you still don't have answers, you know, and which is just heartbreaking. Are they satisfied with how their cases were investigated, and was it thorough?
I mean, I look through the law. I look through the sheriff's department files in Yuba County. It was a thorough investigation. So Yuba County, Sutter County, Butte County, and Plumas County were involved. The California Department of Justice was called in at one point. Volunteers were up in the Plumas searching for the men. They covered ground. We don't know how much ground was covered. But when Ted Weir was discovered in the trailer, it's northeast of where the car was abandoned, near the Daniels Inc. campground, up near the Bucks Lake area. And everyone was just baffled how these men ended up in that location, because one of the detectives investigating the disappearance said, it's almost like a 1 in 1,000 chance they would have been able to walk to that location. There are roads that go through the Plumas that they could have followed, and they could have been plowed by a snowcat a day before, which is one theory. But they couldn't have walked across the land. It's too treacherous. It's too rough terrain. It would have been fatal for all of them to walk the terrain that way. But for Ted Weir to make it to the trailer, it's unbelievable. And did the others make it? It's unbelievable. And to this day, I can say the families understand law enforcement did what they could, but they're not fully sure that it was fully investigated how they got to that spot, because there's a belief among the families that because of the intellectual disabilities, because of mental illness, that it was kind of viewed as, well, they got lost in the woods. What are you going to do? And to this day, that's how the families feel about even how people who discover the case through podcasts and the media sort of dismiss the men as not being smart enough to understand the circumstances. But talking to the families, these men did lead independent lives. They would travel to Sacramento and Chico on trips as friends, and they would make it back successfully and not have any issues with getting lost. It was out of character for them. So in the end, the case is what it is, but the family members still believe something happened that night where the men were sent up into the Plumas. There was either a person or a threat of some kind that got them from one point to another, and everything just kind of went bad from there. It's still frustrating for me even to talk about it, because talking to the families, it's very heartbreaking for him.
Given how much you dug into this over the last 4 years, pulling up investigations, talking with family members, and you're also an archivist by trade as well. I mean, there is the possibility still, since it is a cold case, that something criminal could have taken place. With your vast knowledge about the Yuba County Five, do you think that that is still a possibility to this day?
I believe it is in some way. We just don't know what happened and where it happened, because they were at Chico and then they drive south. And it's possible that they made it to where they took Highway 70 to get back to Marysville instead of 99. That's my belief. For whatever reason, they decided to take that road because it would be an easy exit into Oroville. My thought is they may have stopped at Oroville to use the restroom, or maybe someone wanted to use a payphone for whatever reason. And when they got to Oroville, I think all hell broke loose for whatever reason. They either ran into someone who had a beef with them. They could have run into some drunk people who may have decided to start something with a group of guys who were disabled, and, you know, a guy with mental illness. And what I hope with the book is this book jumpstarts someone's memory and says, this is what happened.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for reviving this. Tony Wright is the author of the new book, Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five. And that wraps up Insight today. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.